I'm Tom Fudge, and we're talking about designing websites these days in San Diego. When a person wanted to go into business back in the old days, they'd find a spot on Main Street and hang out a shingle. These days, you need your shingle in cyberspace. Modern customers expect to find credible companies and organizations on the web. Websites serve the purpose of advertising, commerce, and provision of basic information like phone numbers and product lines. News organizations use them as another way of getting the news out. So what makes for a good website, and what are the latest trends in designing them? We're going to be talking about websites today with Pam Dixon and Joe Crawford. Pam is an author, journalist, and researcher recognized for contributions in the area of technology, privacy, and new media. Pam, thanks for coming in.
It's always a pleasure.
And Joe Crawford is creator of Web San Diego, a mailing list for local web developers and those who work on the Internet. Joe has been a web developer since 1996 and has worked on all aspects of web design and programming. Joe, thanks very much to you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And to our listeners, give us a call if you'd like to talk about websites you like and those you don't like, or if you have any questions for our guests. Our number is 888-895-5727, 888-895-KPBS. Our email address is these days at kpbs.org. And by the way, if you're near a computer, you may want to turn it on. We're going to be talking about a number of sites today, and it might be fun for you to take a look at them as we discuss them. Well, having said all that, Pam, back in the early days of the Internet, who are the people who were designing websites, and and how good a job were they doing?
You know, there was a really stratified layer of people. Back in the late 80s, when I first got on, kind of the mid to late 80s, you had a lot of, I call them really true geeks, you know, people, you know, with the long braids and, you know, the gray hair and the Birkenstocks. Those were the people doing the websites. Also, the fine artists were getting involved with that sort of thing, too. But the thing is that it wasn't the web yet. The web was being created. So when the web finally went mainstream in about 93, 94, and, you know, you got CompuServe and AOL and, you know, pretty much, you know, Joe and Jane Consumer on there, then you started getting the high school students, and then you got the super fine artists. And I think it's really moderated to some degree, but that was then. This is now.
And as you know, the Internet has matured, would you say that the websites have gotten more sophisticated, or, I mean, is there just a wider range of stuff out there?
I think websites have gotten tremendously sophisticated in a lot of ways. First off, they're more visually sophisticated. When you go to a website, you don't expect to see bad design anymore. And I don't know if people kind of, you know, think about that as they're surfing. But, you know, when you look at a site like Google, for example, it's a beautiful, simple design. And if you remember back even 5 years ago, search sites were just loaded with stuff and, you know, distracting, you know, visual icons and stuff. But that's gone. And when you think about Google, it's a simple site, but the back end, the actual search function of the site is extremely sophisticated. So sites have gone way past, you know, just, you know, a cottage industry of, you know, let's slap a site up there. That's not really the way it's being done anymore.
Well, Joe, how would you like to address that same question?
I think that when we talk about design, you know, you don't think about when you go into your lawyer's office about the design of their space, but it says a lot about the credibility, how things are arranged and how you're presented to them. And I think that credibility really is developed out of that aspect of design. But more importantly, is your lawyer a good lawyer? And I think, does your website do what you intend it to do? I think of a site like UPS.com, where you really, there's only basically one thing you want to do. You either want to ship something or you want to track a piece of merchandise. And that site allows you to do that. And that is an aspect of design. And you think, well, that site's very well designed and it's put together well. And you think, well, is that the visual aspect of it? No, it's really the usability and the functionality that people are responding to, I think, when give me what I want when I want it. And Google is no different. It gives you excellent search results. And the design is really an undesign, an afterthought, I think.
One sort of interesting article that I read doing research for this show seemed to indicate that studies show that web design is, in fact, very important in terms of establishing credibility with users. I mean, if a user goes to a site, It's not the information on the site. It's the design of the site. It's the look of the site. Is that true in your experience too, Joe?
I think that that's definitely been my experience. Pam referred to the early days of the web, you know, big gray backgrounds and animated GIFs all over the place, things dancing around the page, because people had a sense that, well, this is an advertising medium. This is like television. And I think today people really are just give me what I want. Give me the thing that I need when I want it. When I go to CNN, I expect to see the current headlines. I don't expect to see the hierarchical structure of CNN.com's board of directors. I want to see the news, and I want to see it right now.
What do you think creates credibility in a website, Pam?
I think you mentioned studies on websites. There's some intensive studies. I mean, I saw a study about a year ago on what colors you use for psychological impact on websites. And, you know, don't use blue, use warm colors. Don't link in purple, you'll look like a flake. I mean, it's amazing. So it's really gotten to be a science, and I think there are some research folks who've probably made some money off of that. But in terms of credibility, I think the one thing that I have really seen become increasingly so is that you've got to have a really unified statement about who you are as a person or as a business. If you go to someone's website and you see trees on their website, their business card had better have that tree on it. And if it doesn't, you know, that's kind of saying to me at least, hey, this person, you know, slapped their website up there and maybe didn't give it a second thought, and maybe it's not updated, and maybe it's not something they care about. And I think in this world, your website is simply a part of how you do business. It's like your business card, but it's more than that. And it's got to really reflect. It's like any good marketing communications or ad person would say to a business, look, you've got your letterhead, make your business cards match your letterhead, make it match your marketing materials. And for heaven's sakes, your website needs to really reflect your company. And I think that's a very, very important part of credibility.
Do you think it's true that for more and more Americans these days, I mean, if you're not on the web, you don't exist?
Absolutely. There's just no question about that. I think that there's a whole generation where if you're not on the web, it doesn't exist.
You agree with that, Joe?
I think that that's definitely becoming the case, whether you want to be on the web or not. Google for your name and you'll likely find yourself. Maybe you took part in a 5K race and your name is part of the standings, or you have a child who's in school and there's a listing there. I think that most people are on the web whether they know it or not.
Ego surfing. That's the official name for searching for your own name, ego surfing.
Ego surfing. Plug your name into Google and see what comes up.
They log all that stuff. It's really embarrassing.
Well, anyway, in terms of establishing credibility for a website, Joe, I guess one thing goes without saying is it's difficult to establish credibility if the website doesn't work very well.
I think that that's absolutely the case. My own background is in programming, engineering, as well as in the arts and in graphic design. But in the programming and engineering aspects are vitally important. If people visit the website and things are exploding all over the place and you see a mysterious scripting error or Microsoft has crashed or, you know, these are all things which do not help your credibility whatsoever. And those kinds of things that can occur in terms of usability and in terms of just good engineering can definitely impact the website in a very bad way. And people may not even be aware of it because people are used to a certain browser and a certain operating system, and that's Windows and that's Internet Explorer. And it's a pity, but often web developers don't consider, well, what other browsers are out there or what old version of AOL are people using to visit the website, and what experience are they having? Are they being driven away simply because something simple doesn't work and because some attention has not been paid to the details of the back end?
You know, and there's an interesting point along with the credibility too. You know, sometimes when I go to sites, I research a lot of privacy issues. And one of the things I'm always looking for is, does this site have a terms of use? Does it have a privacy policy? Have there been complaints made to the Better Business Bureau online about that site and how they've treated consumers, especially if it's some kind of, you know, a site where you're doing some kind of e-commerce? And I think that the actual how a site treats its customers is also part of the equation of credibility. I mean, when you go to the site and you click the contact button, does it go to an email or do you get a phone number? And that's important, too, because, you know, at some point, I put my office number on my website, and everyone was like, Pam, why are you doing that? And I said, because otherwise, how is that credible? If you have a website and you've got your information, are you going to, you know, allow people to check you out? And you have to. There's got to be some kind of verification procedure consumers can use to make sure you're valid and credible, because anyone can put a website up.
That's interesting, because there are so many websites that I often go to get telephone numbers for the organization, and they're not there.
That's not good. They should have those up.
You're listening to These Days. Let me remind listeners that my guests are Pam Dixon and Joe Crawford. Pam Dixon is an author, journalist, and researcher who specializes in areas of new technology. Joe Crawford is creator of Web San Diego, a mailing list for local web developers, and he's been in the business of web developing since 1996. We're talking about websites, what makes a good one, what makes a bad one. If you want to give us a call and talk about your favorite website and tell us why you like it so much, or if you want to put a question to our guests, call us at 888-895-5727. We also invite pet peeves about websites if you want to talk about those. 888-895-KPBS. Let's go to Lori in Claremont. Lori, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for a very good program. I think many employers are looking for people with good web design skills, and I actually teach a class on the Internet about that, and one of the questions my students have is the Americans with Disability Act requirements. How do we make our websites user-friendly for people with various disabilities? And I just wanted to ask your guests if they could address that, because it seems like a good job skill to have, as sites have to be redesigned to meet those requirements. I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It hadn't occurred to me that the ADA might affect websites, but Joe,
That's absolutely a concern, and there have been, I know it was the Olympics in Australia had a number of lawsuits in Australia with regards to that. In our own country, we have what's called Section 508, which deals with electronic media and accessibility of exactly what we were talking about, that a website is really a public affordance. It's something for people to use to get in touch and to use your organization. Section 508 is absolutely necessary. I actually took part in the development of a website called 508help.org with a previous employer, and that was very rewarding to take part in. And that provides the kind of details that I think the caller students would find useful, and would have good links off to the U.S. government sites that have more information about Section 508.
Well, what's an example of an accommodation that would be made to somebody who's disabled on a website? Pam, can you tell us?
It's really simple. Basically, when you have a lot of Java applets and, you know, animation and whatnot, a person, for example, who cannot see the screen is going to be using something called a screen reader. And the screen reader just literally passes across the screen and reads the text that is there. And if you have an image, your image should have a little name on it. If it doesn't, it will just say image. But if you have, like if you put a caption in your image, like going back to my example, let's say you have a picture of a desk on your site. In your image, this particular teacher could instruct her students to always put a caption and say, this is a desk. And when it says that, the person who's using the screen reader will then know it's a desk. And that's just one small example.
So with this software that they supposedly have, you can click on that and
it reads the screen.
And it will say, this is a desk.
That's right. Otherwise, it'll say, image. And, you know, it's very useful for absolutely everyone to download a screen reader. They're not very expensive. They're less than $100. And have it read your site. It's just shocking.
It is a very interesting field. And when we talk about users with disabilities, we're talking not just about visual impairments. We're talking also about people who maybe are deaf or have different hearing capabilities. I mean, we're on the radio, so there's an obvious difference there. But people are familiar with the idea of television and closed captioning, and it's really no different than that. And again, we think about real-world analogs. We're talking about curb cuts and ramps for buildings. It's really a means to allow people to get at your content. Maybe they're not going to have precisely the same experience because their sensorium is going to be different than a typical human being, but they're going to get an experience that's going to be similar. I forget the exact language in Section 508, but you should be able to get at the content and have a meaningful experience.
Okay, with that, we have to take a break. We're talking about websites during this hour of These Days. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll get to your calls at 888-895-KPBS. I'm Tom Fudge. It's These Days on KPBS. During this hour, we're talking about websites, which are the ones we like, which are the ones we dislike, which are the ones which are really successful in serving a business or serving the people who use it. My guests are Pam Dixon and Joe Crawford. Pam is an author, journalist, and researcher who is a specialist in the area of new technology and new media. Joe Crawford is the creator of Web San Diego, a mailing list for local web developers and others who work on the Internet. Joe has been a web developer since 1996. If you want to give us a call, our number is 888-895-5727. Our lines may be full up at the moment, but try us later in the show if they are. Our number is 888-895-KPBS. And let's take a call from Yusuf in Encinitas. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask a question about what Joe and Pam think about the overall security of websites, especially nowadays since, you know, with all this hacking stuff going on. I think that's a pretty big important thing that, you know, might put off a lot of e-commerce type of...
Okay, Yusuf, you're kind of breaking up there. We'll have to let you go. But the question is about security of websites. Pam?
Oh, boy. That's like a Pandora's box. Look, the security of websites is just such a huge issue. I was just talking to someone yesterday about a very large case that was brought against Zeff Davis last August by the New York Attorney General's office. And basically, they sued Davis, Zeff Davis, for not having good security on their website. They exposed everyone's email addresses and credit card numbers. And, you know, this is Zeff Davis. These guys are, you know, like computer publishers. And look, if they can do it, anyone can do it. And security is...
If they can blow it,
yeah,
then anybody can blow it.
Yeah, if they can have that problem, you can just imagine that there's a lot of problems out there. Look, I can't lie. The security issues on websites, particularly those websites that compile consumer information like resume databases, let me tell you, there's some real serious problems out there.
You know, Joe, I'm still sort of at a point where I am reluctant to, you know, put my credit card number, give my credit card number to any Internet site. I mean, what's your response to our question?
I think that this is a thing that prevents a lot of people from using the Internet to the fullest extent that they can. I have several family members who simply say, oh, that Internet, you just can't put that number out there. What am I doing putting that credit card number in there? And it is difficult to have that level of trust of, should I be putting this in? And there are features in newer browsers that include security certificates, and you got to make sure that when you buy something online, you see that little lock or that little special key in the bottom corner of your browser to assure that when you're sending information that's sensitive to you, particularly credit card numbers, but other information as well, that it's being sent over an encrypted channel. Now, in the case of something like Zeff Davis or other retailers or entities which have poor security, I think that that's really a failing of my business. It's a failing of developers to adequately secure what needs to be secured. I don't know that we're going to see government regulation in this area, but I know that people are crying in the business to say, no, please don't regulate us. But if we continue to see the kind of security problems that we see today, I think that kind of regulation will come. And I think that should light a fire under the folks who do these kinds of things for a living.
Let's go to Karen in Hamul. Go ahead, Karen.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. This is a really great subject. I've been browsing the Internet since about 1995, and back then my chosen browser was Netscape, and I kept up with the different versions. But last fall, I discovered Opera, and it's a new browser that is out of, I think, Norway, and it has all kinds of really great features. It's just really neat. I mean, I had it for about 4 days and sent in the money to register it, so I didn't have to look at their little banner ad.
That's funny.
Okay, well, Opera. Pam, you use it.
I do. Opera, I'm so glad that this caller called in. I love Opera, too. It's my favorite browser, and I've got the funniest story for you. There's a very accomplished technical expert. His name is Fravia, and he's over in Europe, in Belgium, and he has a website called searchlores.com. And if you go to that website and you're not using Opera, you can't get in. The website actually checks for your use of Opera. And when you go to that website and you get in using Opera, it basically says, look, if you're not using Opera, you're not using a real web browser. Basically, Opera is a very, very fast web browser, and there's a lot of controls on it, on how you get the information, and it's terrific.
It is a great browser. I think that one of the things that I was talking about earlier was that people will come at you with a browser that you don't expect. I used to like to think of it as whatever browser you're testing for, that's exactly the browser that the CEO of the company that you're developing the website for will be using. Absolutely. I mean, I remember a CEO using Netscape 2 when Netscape 3 was in the vogue, and I was developing the site with all this JavaScript, and that was a very valuable lesson to me because the site basically just exploded for the CEO. And that's, you know, you just can't have that happen. And I think that we're going to continue to see new browsers come out. On the Macintosh, there's a new browser called Safari, which is excellent. And it also has some of the attributes that Opera does, which is it's very, very fast and very good, very useful. Are developers testing for it? Not necessarily. Should they? Yes, they should.
Probably. Yeah, they should probably start with Safari.
Well, how big an issue is this business of incompatibility between websites
Huge.
And certain browsers?
Huge.
You know, for
Huge
instance,
issue.
I've been using Netscape for years, and I might be a little bit concerned about moving to something else. Not that I'm sure that Netscape is the best, but, you know, if I go to Opera, am I going to be able to get all the sites that
Actually,
I get now?
Actually, you'll do better than you are right now on Netscape. Netscape has a lot of incompatibility issues. You know, I'll tell you, I think the incompatibility issue is fairly huge. I put something on my own website and centered it, and it looked great in every browser but Netscape. And I had to go back and totally redo it because it was so blown on Netscape. And, you know, I just checked Netscape just because that's what I do before I put anything up. Mm-hmm. And if I hadn't checked it, it would have absolutely looked horrible. And, it, you know, that makes you look bad. You've got to check all the browsers.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that has changed in web design is that designers and developers are much more cognizant of web standards. I was actually part of a movement that got kind of sick of this aspect of web browsers where, well, it works in IE and it doesn't work in Netscape. Mm-hmm. And, why are there all these differences between how the browsers work? And it was at the point where for a commercial site, you were basically developing the website two times. A group of us got fed up with that and formed the Web Standards Project back in 1999. So an effort basically to pressure browser makers to make their browsers better and to conform to what are called the W3C standards for HTML, CSS, and ECMAScript, which hopefully will provide, if people design and develop to these standards, you're going to have better compatibility. This is the idea and the ideal.
Going to get back to our callers in just a moment, but Joe, I did want to ask you this question. There was a time when I have to think that website design was very much influenced by the prevailing speed of internet connections. You know, I mean, there's no point in having a lot of groovy moving pictures on your website if it takes forever to download them. Where are we at today in terms of connection speed and what you can put on a website.
I think that one of the things that occurs in San Diego is that we're all very spoiled. Broadband is very ubiquitous. We've got at least three providers of cable modem access, as well as lots of DSL providers. But I think that developers really need to be cognizant of the fact that not everyone is going to have that level of sophistication and that level of speed out there across the land. And remember, what we're talking about is a global audience when we talk about a
right.
web audience. And so it's very important for a developer to know their audience very well, who's going to be visiting the site, who has an interest in the site, and to be sensitive when developing the website to, well, if I put this movie up on the site, are they going to be able to see it? Is it going to take too long for them to download or not, or have it be an option? And those kinds of sensitivities to audience, which is really what occurs in any media, is what should happen in web development.
There was a real funny moment back in 1999 where I called it the broadband moment, where, you know, there were broadband-only sites where you'd go to, like, Cox at Home, and it would just be evil, I mean, unless you were on broadband. And now something that's emerging that's very interesting is this whole wireless issue. Many, many people are approaching the web on some kind of wireless device or modem. I know that I access the web on my Palm 7, and believe me, I want the text. I just give me the information, skip the graphics, and, you know. I think that's a growing trend as well.
You're listening to These Days. I'm talking with Pam Dixon, who's an author and journalist, a specialist in new technology, and Joe Crawford, creator of Web San Diego. Our number is 888-895-KPBS, talking about websites. Let's get back to our callers, starting with Michelle in Pacific Beach. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, guys. Great show. Great show. I couldn't agree with you more in terms of your comments. I have a very brief comment and then a question for your guests. I work for a company called Pint, and my boss is a teacher at UCSD, Thomas Powell. He's actually written 7 textbooks on web development and standards. And I'm wondering if you guys are finding that part of the problem here is that the people that buy websites, the CEOs, as you referred to, Joe, mm-hmm. Often do not understand the product that they're buying.
Well, I think that's probably definitely a common thing that occurs. People think they're buying a piece of collateral. They think they're buying a brochure. And what they're really buying is a piece of credibility. And also, often, if you're going to do something on the web, it's going to be a piece of functionality. I know that Pint does a lot of work with intranets, if I know that correctly, and lots of development in that area. And that's an example where what's really occurring is back-end business work, and it's absolutely important that that work, 100%. As far as the misconceptions about what a website is, I think it's a matter for web developers to educate.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Let's go to Bira, also in Pacific Beach. Go ahead, Bira.
Hi, hello.
Hello, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm listening to you guys like 5 days a week. Great show. I have just one little question and one quick comment. My question is about usability. I'd like you guys talk a little bit more about usability because I totally agree with what you guys talked so far. And I just take the answer out of the air. The comment that I have to make, it's about this website that I think it's great. It's becominghuman.org. It's from Arizona University, and they have a really great study about the first apes who stand up and our ancestors.
It's called Becoming Human?
Becominghuman.org. Actually, they have a lot of Flash and director animated, and the cool thing is that it's really good taste. It's not really like a movie or anything, but they know how to use those features and basic and usability, which was my first question. Mm-hmm. I will take the answer out of the air. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks very much.
I guess the questioner is asking a little bit about usability and about functionality on websites. And I think that a good place, I guess the questioner is asking what a good site for that would be. And I think probably Jacob Nielsen's site would be an excellent site to look at. Useit, useit.com. And lots of excellent thinking on usability, as well as links out to other sites on that.
USEIT.com.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And as far as the site that the caller mentioned, multimedia as an educational tool can be really wonderful, and that's something that we've had, you know, since I was in grade school. You know, there's a 20-year history of using multimedia to educate and to inform, where people can really interact and go at their own pace in learning something in the sciences, say.
I think there's an interesting issue too that the caller brought up. And that's, you know, when the web first came out, it really wasn't the web. It was the internet, and we were looking at text only on black or green backgrounds. And at that point, there were a lot of scientific studies. There was a lot of data and really hardcore information online. And then we went into this phase in the 90s where it was a lot of visuals and not as much free information. And we're coming back. And he mentioned the becominghuman.org. You know, that's a beautiful site, and it is beautifully done. It's a lot of information. And I think the beautiful thing is we're coming back more to not just a commercial web, but also some, you know, science, some more altruism out there, as opposed to we're not just in this, you know, web thing to make a buck. I think we all realize that no one's going to exactly make a buck just from being on the web.
Pam, graphically, do the same rules apply to a website that would apply to, say, the contents page of a magazine, and just in terms of making it look good? What do you think?
I think that there are a whole new set of rules. And I think you see a lot of sites right now that are trying to apply the old rules to the new medium, and it's not exactly working.
Well, I'm thinking about rules like, you know, providing just some white space in there so there's not too much text. I mean, a lot of this stuff does apply, it seems
basic
to me, to different...
Basic good design, I don't think ever goes away, if that's what you're talking about. Yeah, white space is great. I think that some people would disagree with me and they like to see every little inch filled. But yeah, I think that the basic, you know, give it space, make it clean, make it modern looking. I think that's very appropriate.
Yeah, I think that the principles of graphic design that have occurred over the past, you know, since the invention of movable type, still apply. And it's about allowing the eye to focus on areas of a page, and in this case, it's a virtual page. It's a page that can scroll as long as probably as infinity, theoretically. But the idea is that you guide the user's eye in a way that's going to be meaningful. What do you want them to look at first? What impression do you want them to feel? And you do that by using form and by using color and by using space and negative space.
But some things do change on the web. When you see a hyperlink, it is distracting. And you've got to figure out how you want to deal with that distraction, or even if you want to give the reader or the page user that distraction.
Let's take one more call before we have to take another break. Bob is in Chula Vista. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi there. I'm sitting here designing a website for a client.
All right.
Listening to the radio. I was wondering, if they have any suggestions. My biggest problem I find out is that end users, I deal with mostly small companies, they have their own design ideas that usually run contrary to common, you know, the common held beliefs. And I spend a lot of time trying to tell them, you know, you don't need flashing graphics or, you know, complex backgrounds or, watch the speed.
Definitely.
Stupid clients. Anyway.
we love them and we hate them.
I know. That's what's happening with me, actually. I mean, it just, you know, you bang up. Do you have any good ways of talking to these people and, you know, maybe, you know, giving them some ideas?
I think that in my own experience, it really is a matter of communicating in a manner that's gentle and informing, but also firm. If you're talking about the color, you're missing the point of the website, probably. If it's a matter of different shades of green, maybe you're not really focusing on what's important. You really have to get your client focused on, well, what are your intentions for the website? What would you like to communicate? What would you like the user, the visitor to your website, you're welcoming them into a space that's yours. What impression do you want to leave them with? Do you want to leave them with the impression that you're part of some X Games phenomena where things are whizzing around the screen, or would you like them to have an excellent, classy impression of you?
Well, we have to take another break. You're listening to These Days on KPBS. We'll be back with Joe Crawford and Pam Dixon talking about websites in just a moment. Our call-in number is 888-895-KPBS. I'm Tom Fudge. You're listening to These Days, and we're talking about designing websites this hour. My guests are Joe Crawford and Pam Dixon. Joe is creator of Web San Diego, a mailing list for local web developers and others who work on the Internet. He's been a web developer himself since about 1996. And Pam Dixon is an author, journalist, and researcher who is recognized for her specialty in new technology and new media. 888-895-KPBS. Is the number to call if you'd like. Our email address, by the way, is thesedays@kpbs.org. Spencer is calling from Encinitas. Go ahead, Spencer.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
All this talk about color and stuff. What software do you guys use for like Color Wheel to figure out exactly what colors to use?
Well, the thing I think of first is probably a tool called Visibone, V-I-S-I-B-O-N-E, and they make color charts and mouse pads, and as well as electronic versions that will fit into Photoshop or Illustrator that will allow you to kind of to see what colors you can use on the web, as well as they have a tool online to allow you to do kind of dynamic selections of see what color combinations look like.
I use actually a combination of methods because I don't actually use that. I think for me, I like to use a combination of Dreamweaver, and I also like to use Illustrator, which is, of course, an Adobe product. And then I like to do a preview and see how those colors are looking. In most of the various paint and visual creation programs now, they allow you to actually choose a web palette. And if you can choose the web palette and then take a look at how that looks, it makes a big difference. But, you know, sometimes it's good to not just stick to that, to experiment beyond the bounds and see where it goes. And you can especially do this with photographs. And if you use something like a Corel Photo Paint or, you know, the various photo paint programs, you can really get some unique colors that actually look really good on the web, even though they're not web colors.
Pam, there are all sorts of people out there, do-it-yourselfers, who are creating their own personal websites. You know, your family might have a site to put pictures of the kids up there, so grandma, who's 2,000 miles away, can look at the pictures. I mean, how easy is it and how expensive is it for just anybody to create their own website and maintain it?
I really do believe that if someone wants to create their own website, the easiest place to do that right now is at Blogger, which is a website where you can just create your own online journal. And I think that's really effective for the home user because you go there, you slap it up, and you're done. And I think also some of the free sites that your internet service provider allows you to have is really easy. They just let you format it, and they usually have these little forms where you add this and that, and then they pop it up for you. And that's really the easiest way. But some of these programs, I don't personally use Front Page, but Front Page I know that is very effective for people. Dreamweaver, I think, is a great program. It's probably a little more intensive than some people might want. And then for the geeks, you can always code it yourself. HTML is not actually that hard.
Joe, did you want to chime in?
I think that it's wonderful, the democratization of web design, is, and that really anyone can learn to do these things. This is not some black art where, oh, I'm never going to learn how to do this. It's too hard. There are lots of tools out there available to people. I think of tools like GoLive and more smaller scale tools like Macromedia's new Contribute product and a product called CityDesk, which allow people to put things up and to really kind of maintain and control them themselves. And I think that the way I started was I had an account with Earthlink at, you know, years ago, and they gave me this free web space. And what was I going to do with it? I had no idea. But they had resources for me to look for and look at, and I managed to teach myself. The thing about the web that's great is that everything that you can do on the web, you can probably learn on the web. It's sort of self-evident.
But for people who don't want to put the time in to learn to get to Joe's level, you really can just, there's some very simple forms that you can go to, like GeoCities and these various other real super consumer-friendly places, and just, you know, get something up in a couple hours.
And generally, I'm assuming your service provider, if you want to put up a website, is going to charge you a certain amount of money.
Or even sometimes it's free, and that can be part of how you choose a service provider.
Let's go to Justin, who's on the I-8. Go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, I actually have two questions. The first one is, I'm recently laid off, programmer, and oddly enough, I had a chance to sort of see this out-of-control corporate spending on IT stuff, because my girlfriend works for a large consulting firm and in the financial department, and they were working on the email system for the county. And this was running into the millions of dollars for, you know, 15,000 users.
Wow.
And I was working on an email system for our 45,000 customers that needed email. And we had a web product, and part of that was an email deal. And I had to do the budgeting, the planning, the whole deal. And the hardware side of things was about 70 grand. And we got it up in a few months. And we transitioned people from Critical Path into the in-house deal. And I think the whole budget, including HR time and that sort of thing, was, you know, 150 grand or something like that.
So your point is that a lot of people get ripped off in this area?
Well, it seems like certain entities, large corporations or counties, you know, governments and that sort of thing, won't look at something unless it costs, you know, X million dollars. They think it can't be done.
Yeah.
And this is like a really growing concern I have. I mean, this is our county, and they're spending all this money that's our money, right? And I'm a Democrat, so I approve that. But
you're all in favor of spending too much tax money.
Yeah, right. But I mean, the point is like, that seems just ludicrous to me.
Okay, thanks, Justin. Pam, what can we say to that?
You know what? This kind of overspending is so much less frequently seen now than it was in the past couple of years. I really do think this sort of thing is going away. I think people are starting to realize that they don't need to spend $5 million to create a website. But I'll tell you, I think that there's a little bit of, you know, hangover from the late 90s that our caller is talking about here. I'm not really seeing that same thing. I'm seeing more that the people I know who are web developers are having to, you know, fight for their rates. And I think that there was some inflation, and especially in New York City, where, you know, if you were a web designer, man, you were living high, you know, you were living large. But I think that inflation has really come down, and I'm just not seeing that trend.
Yeah, I think that what I've seen, you know, I speak with web developers basically every day, and I think that the overspending aspect of the web is definitely something that's diminishing. It's not that it can't happen. I think that you look at at any examples of corporate abuse and overspending, and you know, where is that money going, and even talking about you know, government entities, you know, are they putting their dollars into things that are really going to return on investment, this ROI that we hear so much about, you know, are you going to get bang for your buck? And I think that's the question that taxpayers need to ask of their government entities. You know, what are you spending our money on, and is there a better way to do it? Is there enough oversight from the community?
There's an interesting aspect to what the caller was talking about, though, and that is this. You know, if you want a really bad website, just, you know, try to do it yourself. But uh-huh. if you're a corporation, you know what? A website is going to cost money to develop correctly, because you might get a pretty design for less money, but you've got to think about the back end. Is there a database tied in? What kind of you know, data collection do you need it to do? What, I mean, are you in airlines? I mean, you just can't just slap something up and not expect to pay money anymore. I mean, I remember at a time when, you know, you'd see web designers advertising for $50 for a website. Those days are gone.
Well, those days are really not gone, but it's much harder to make those sales.
Well, speaking of all this, let's go to Stephen in Solana Beach. Stephen, go ahead.
Yes, well, it's a rather, well, possibly simple or complex question, depending. But my question would be, how do you price out a website? I mean, you can start from $50, you can go to $1 million, but actually, how do you do that? Because there's the design side, there's the actual, you know, creating the pages and the links and the imagery. How do you price these things out? I'd be curious, you know, kind of the different arenas where you price.
Well, this is one of the tricky things, and part of the business of building. And it's like any engineering or architectural task is you end up building the plans for the website. What does the website need to do? And what is the timeline for developing the website? And how much time is it going to take to actually build these plans that you've developed? Design is typically a smaller chunk of a dynamic website, say a site that has a lot of database interactivity, and most of the budget is going to be in that the engineering side of things. If you've got a very small website and you only need to communicate a very few things, maybe most of your budget is going to be in design and in actually just building those initial pages.
Now, Joe, does the designer and the engineer of a website tend to be different people or the same person?
It completely depends, but typically what I've seen is that a designer really handles that kind of front end, the look and feel and the interaction, and that it'll be engineers who are handling the programming and more of the in-depth coding. So it's rare to see jack of all trades. I happen to be kind of a jack of all trades. I can do both of those aspects, but it's more common to see a division of labor.
Yeah, that's true. And I would recommend for the caller, for Stephen, to really think about this. When you go to a website and you like it, take a look at who designed it, because the designer will usually have some kind of link on the page. And go to that link, check out the designer, and make phone calls. That you look for a good web designer the same way you look for a good financial advisor. You talk to everyone you know, ask them who they used, how much it cost, and how they liked working with them. Because you can, working with a web designer or a web design team, there's got to be a good chemistry there. And if there's not, you can end up with a bad product.
We got an email from Rachel who says she keeps running into websites that are impossible to read because of the print and the backgrounds. You need to consider more of us who are wearing bifocals.
Oh.
I don't care how groovy a site is if I can't read it. And you do still come across those sites that are like blue print on a black background.
I don't know.
I don't know why people do that.
It's crazy.
And it's interesting that's an aspect of what we talked about earlier. Accessibility is adequate contrast in the pages that for reading. You know, if someone gave you a book that was blue on black print, that would be extremely difficult to read. Maybe that would be the early days of Wired magazine, you know, mm-hmm. super fancy, but very, very difficult to read. But if you want people to read your text, you should provide adequate contrast and adequate text size.
Let's go to Art, who's on the I-8 freeway. Go ahead, Art. You're on the show.
Hi. My question is about content versus design. And what I notice is I go on some sites, I bought a consumer product, and I go on their site, and there's no online manuals.
Mm.
And I just find that sort of makes those sites irrelevant or not very useful.
That's right.
other products, like I bought a natural turkey one on the website. Great. They've got wines to pair with it, how to cook it, all those sort of things. So I guess it's more of a comment is retailers need to put essential information versus just bells and whistles.
Well, yes, that was thoughtful. The turkey folk, whoever did that, they were thoughtful.
Yeah, and that's an aspect of knowing what your audience is going to expect from you. Why doesn't it make sense for you to be able to go to, say you've got a car, and you go to the car dealer's website or to the manufacturer of the car, and you want to know, well, how often do I get my oil checked? You should be able to find that information. That's the kind of information, rich information, that you're not going to find in your local newspaper. You may have to go down to a bookstore. But if you can put it on the web, why not do that? Anticipate what the users of your product are going to need when they come to the web.
Well, we're almost out of time, and we've got a ton of calls that I'm sad to say we're just not going to get to. But before we run out of time, Pam, what's a blog site, and is there one that you like?
Yeah, a blog is essentially a ridiculous name for a web blog. It's a journal that's done online. I absolutely love AndrewSullivan.com. I love the site. I think it's groundbreaking in so many ways. First, he asks you to donate money to him, which I think is funny. And it's controversial, and you hear about it. I also love Polytech, which is a politics and technology site by Declan McCullough. That's a good site, too. He also asks for money. But basically, these are lively sites filled with conversation and ideas, and they get you thinking and talking.
I think those are two good examples of blogs, particularly Declan McCullough. And those are examples of journalists who have used the web to kind of transcend their freelance nature, which I think is absolutely wonderful. I run a site called San Diego Bloggers. It's at websandiego.org/bloggers with lots of local folks who put blogs together, including myself. And I think that a blog is a great way to continuously update people on your life and to point out what's interesting to you right now.
And a blog is casual. It's not formal.
That's right.
Okay. Well, with that, we're going to have to call it off. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us. Pam Dixon is an author, journalist, and researcher who specializes in areas of new technology and new media. Pam, thanks for coming on.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
And Joe Crawford is creator of Web San Diego, a mailing list for local web developers and others who work in the World Wide Web. Joe has been a web developer since about 1996. Joe, thanks to you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to those who listened. Thanks to those who called in. And my apologies to those callers. We couldn't put on the show. If you have a question or comment about something you've heard on These Days, you can call our listener response line, 619-594-2220, or send us an email at thesedays@kpbs.org. We may read your email on the air, so please include the name of your home community and tell us your first and last name. I'm Tom Fudge. You've been listening to These Days on KPBS.